You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
Volcanic eruptions in Alaska linked to social conflict in ancient Egypt? Historical accounts, archaeological data, and recent environmental research brought to light multiple accounts where the fates of entire civilizations have been affected by climatic events and resulting social conflict. In this episode of Archaeological Context, we focus on the 1st century BCE in the Eastern Mediterranean region, a period marked by the end of the Roman Republic, the rise of the Roman Empire, and the end of the reign of the Ptolemaic dynasty in Egypt. Recent multidisciplinary research by the guest of this episode, Dr. Joe Manning from the Yale University, has highlighted the pivotal role played by a massive volcanic eruption in Alaska and resulting climatic fluctuations that likely helped to trigger the transformative moments in the middle of the 1st century BCE. Here's already an extract of our conversation.
Cleopatra is having a lot of difficulties, not just with now flooding, but with a lot of threats to her independence, to Egypt's independence, threatened by Rome actually for quite a long period of time, as Rome has come to dominate the Eastern Mediterranean world since around 200 BC or so, since the defeat of Carthage. For sure, Rome was becoming more and more dominant. Mm-hmm. So it's a real turning point, the last 50 years BCE, certainly in Mediterranean history. And the volcano, the Ukmuk, is a very large eruption. It's no ordinary eruption. You can see photographs from satellites of Umnak Island on a clear day, and you can see the caldera of Ukmuk, Ukmuk II, as it's called, the eruption in 43 BC now. It was quite large eruption. It's the largest eruption in the Northern Hemisphere in the last 2,500 years, for example. So it's a very significant eruption. It had global climate impacts, it looks like. And it certainly impacts Nile flooding, we know from historical sources, for probably a few years, at a time when the Nile flood was already sort of weakened from just natural variability. Mm-hmm. So this looks like this compounds problems in Egypt.
As a quick overview, the Ptolemaic kingdom emerged in 305 BCE when Ptolemy I Soter, a Macedonian Greek general of Alexander the Great, seized control in Egypt and established his dynasty. It would last for nearly three centuries until the reign of the famous Cleopatra VII ended in the year 30 BCE. Despite being of, quote, Greek descent, the Ptolemies ruled Egypt by blending Hellenistic and Egyptian traditions to some extent and adopting the title of pharaoh, for example. Alexandria, their capital, flourished as a center of culture, trade, and architectural advancements, signified, for example, by the legendary Great Library and the Pharaoh's Lighthouse, one of the seven wonders of the ancient world. However, economic difficulties, especially grain shortages, inflation, oppressive taxation, and ethnic tensions often led to riots and public disorder. Without going into the details here, many uprisings are recorded for Ptolemaic Egypt in the 2nd and 1st century BCE, like, for example, the Memphis Revolt, the Theban Revolt, the Great Revolt, or the Alexandrian Riots. These social conflicts also reflect the complex dynamics between Greek rulers and the Egyptian population during the Ptolemaic era. eventually internal conflict as well as external pressures, especially from Rome, led to its eventual annexation by the latter in the year 30 BCE, ending 300 years of Ptolemaic rule in Egypt. As we heard, mainly grain shortages led to these revolts, and historical accounts paint a vivid picture of environmental distress with famine and resulting disease gripping Ptolemaic Egypt, especially in the 1st century BCE. So the question arises, what caused these grain shortages in such a well-organized ancient society? To answer this, we turn to recent findings from well-dated volcanic fallout records in 6 Arctic ice cores, which have unveiled evidence of a colossal volcanic eruption in early 43 BCE, originating from Alaska's Okmok volcano. This catastrophic event marks one of the largest volcanic eruptions of the past 2,500 years and severely affected the Northern Hemisphere, with temperatures plummeting to levels unseen in millennia. Climate proxy records show that 43 and 42 BCE were among the coldest years in recent millennia in the Northern Hemisphere. Earth system modeling suggests that radiative forcing from this massive, high-latitude eruption led to pronounced changes in the hydroclimate, including seasonal temperatures in specific Mediterranean regions as much as 7 degrees Celsius below normal. And also, contemporary written sources describe unusual climate conditions, especially the so-called nilometer measurements recorded on papyrus scrolls. In short, a nilometer was an ancient instrument used in Egypt to measure the River Nile's water levels during its annual floods. It consisted of a series of marked steps or a graduated column placed in a well or along the riverbank. By tracking the height of the Nile's floodwaters, the nilometer helped to predict agricultural yields, tax levels, and potential for famine. The measurements therefore provided a critical information for managing irrigation and understanding the seasonal flooding essential to ancient Egyptian agriculture. Taken together, the hydroclimate turmoil from the outbreak of the Okmok volcano in 43 BCE led to crop failures and food shortages, which sparked repeating and widespread social conflict in ancient Egypt. 2,000 years after the outbreak of the Okmok volcano, we today also face many different climate crises across the globe. The intricate correlation between volcanoes, climate, and societal dynamics underscores the fragility of civilizations in the face of environmental distress. The urgency of integrating historical insights into modern-day risk assessment and mitigation strategies should therefore be evident. As we face the uncertainties of the future, the adaptation strategies of the past can maybe help us towards climate resilience and sustainability. And with that, I am very happy to present you my conversation with Dr. Joe Manning, professor of classics, history, and the Yale School of the Environment from the Yale University. Professor Manning, thank you very much for taking the time to speak with me. And maybe first, I was wondering, considering the Nile's crucial role in sustaining life and shaping ancient Egyptian civilization or civilizations, how could volcanic eruptions from the other side of the world, specifically the Okmok volcano in Alaska in 43 BCE, alter the annual floods of the Nile in Egypt?
That's a great question, Noah. It's great to be here with you this afternoon for me. It's a bit surprising to a lot of people to realize that there are these global connections, what climate scientists call teleconnection, between a large eruption and the East African monsoon, which is the driver of the annual flood of the Nile River, but there, we have now established, climate scientists have established for a while, this teleconnection through the atmosphere. It's relatively complicated. It has to do with the sun and solar radiation hitting the earth or reduction thereof. And the East African monsoon is quite sensitive to this radiative forcing, as it's called. So it's a very interesting phenomenon. It's quite complex. I don't think it's fully worked out yet even, but I think the basics are the dynamics of the atmospheric circulation of the monsoon is pretty well established, I think. So that's how it's connected.
Okay. And so what were the broader implications of this eruption for agriculture and also trade in the, well, now speaking in the Eastern Mediterranean region during this period of the first century BCE?
This is a very interesting period historically, of course. The last 50 years BCE in the Eastern Mediterranean, other places in the world too. But in the Eastern Mediterranean, it's quite a dramatic period as the Roman Republic is coming to an end in civil war and military campaigning by some famous generals, of course, looking for advantage. But it's also the Egypt of Cleopatra, the last of the Ptolemaic kings, the last ruling dynasty of Egypt. And we know that Cleopatra is having a lot of difficulties, not just with now flooding, but with a lot of threats to her independence, to Egypt's independence, threatened by Rome actually for quite a long period of time, as Rome has come to dominate the Eastern Mediterranean world since around 200 BC or so, since the defeat of Carthage. For sure, Rome was becoming more and more dominant. Mm-hmm. So it's a real turning point, the last 50 years BCE, certainly in Mediterranean history. And the volcano, the Okmok is a very large eruption. It's no ordinary eruption. You can see photographs from satellites of Umnak Island on a clear day, and you can see the caldera of Okmok II, as it's called, the eruption in 43 BC now. It was quite large eruption. It's the largest eruption in the Northern Hemisphere in the last 2,500 years, for example. So it's a very significant eruption. It had global climate impacts, it looks like. And it certainly impacts Nile flooding. We know from historical sources, for example, probably a few years, at a time when the Nile flood was already sort of weakened from just natural variability. Probably we know in 50 BC and 49 BC, the Nile flood was, and even 47, the Nile flood was already low. Mm-hmm. So this looks like this compounds problems in Egypt. And we don't have agricultural records, so we can't say for sure it impacts the agricultural production, of course. But I think it must have, given the several years of low flooding. It would have been a critical shock to agricultural production, which is dependent completely on the annual flood of the river. So it would have impacted food supply, agricultural production to some extent. We can't directly prove it. I don't have price data, for example, that would show that, but it seems fairly logical. It would have impacted agriculture. And there are also hints in the northern part of the Mediterranean world, in Italy and other parts of the Eastern Mediterranean, that there are also problems with agriculture in these years.
If I can ask to this, so we don't have any records about agricultural production if it was lower, because I mean, do we have records of lower taxes that they got, or that they needed to shift maybe to import more grain from other places, or how do we have no records of this?
Yeah, no. Well, we have historical hints. There's a famous text from 50 BC where Cleopatra issues a royal decree statewide, under pain of death, merchants must ship grain to Alexandria. So it's already very sensitive. Mm-hmm. A very large city, of course, is quite vulnerable. We have historical records in the late 40s BC to talk about food crises. People are panicking. Local governors are trying to figure out how to save the day. So It's pretty clear there's stress from the historical record we have. We don't have a lot of direct historical records from this period, which is interesting. And it might be related to all the chaos, actually, that things just don't survive. But everything we have tells the same story, that there's now flood stress. We hear that Cleopatra opens up the royal granaries in Alexandria to feed people, for example. That's a fairly extraordinary move as well. So everything we do have suggests that it was a very distressed period.
Interesting, yeah. And exploring this evidence from social conflict and maybe migrations or shifts in power dynamics, could you shed light on how volcanic aftermaths affected this resource availability and unrest specifically in Ptolemaic Egypt?
Yeah, so the Nile project that I've been directing now for a while with lots of great scientists and colleagues around the world, including some colleagues in Bern, Michael Siegel, for example. You know, we begin to see patterns of now flood behavior and volcanic eruptions. Usually eruptions perturb the East African monsoon for maybe a year or two, depending on the time of the eruption. What's so critical about the Okmok eruption is Joe McConnell and colleagues in Ireland, Jill Plunkett in Belfast, the TEFRA analysis that she did that fingerprinted Okmok is astoundingly good science. But Joe's dated the eruption to the winter 43 BC, and that's really significant. So January, February, that's how precise he thinks he can date this eruption from, from Greenland ice cores. That's significant because the Nile starts to flood in June every year. The monsoon rains hit the Ethiopian highlands, which is about 80% or so of the annual flood of the river, the Blue Nile source. That begins about June, and then it floods through the summer. So if an eruption begins in June, it's not going to impact the annual rainfall then, because it's already raining.
Yeah.
So the fact that it's winter is really important for Okmok, because that's enough time to impact the annual flood of the river that year in the summer of 43 BC, we think. And it looks like from the tree rings that the impact of Okmok is several years. I mean, the cooling is incredible. It was quite cold in that the following summer, for example, and very wet in the north part of the Mediterranean too. So it has rather dramatic impacts.
I read 7 degrees lower than usual in your paper.
Yeah, 7 degrees Celsius. I think, yeah, that is actually quite shocking. I mean, that's really, it gives you a sense of how big the impact of Okmok would have been. Yeah.
And speaking of the impact of Okmok, your research hints at adaptations also in legal systems and maybe trade networks due to these climatic shifts or eruptions. Can you provide insights into how such events influenced legal frameworks or also economic practices in Ptolemaic ancient Egypt?
That's a big question. I'll try to do my best. Yeah. So yeah. What's interesting, of course, about volcanic eruptions is that normally with climate history, we're used to working on decades or centuries. And volcanic eruptions typically will impact climate, will cool the Northern Hemisphere, for example, for a year, maybe two. On one hand, what we've been doing with people like Michael Siegel and Joe McConnell at the Desert Research Institute is trying to look at decades and multiple eruptions in a decade. And that happens quite often. So the ice core record is really important for us because we can see pretty stressed out decades. The 160s BC we've worked on, for example. There's a second eruption before Okmok. I think it's 47 BC. So when you have clusters of eruptions, it looks like there's a new paper that just came out with Michael Siegel and others that does suggest that there is a compounding effect of two or three eruptions that happen in a short period of time. So it'll prolong the cooling. And so that's important for us to look at not just a bad year, for example, because with grain storage in the Mediterranean world, in Egypt in particular, you can store grain for maybe 2 years. So that gives you your buffer. And if you have a problem more than 2 years, you're going to be really stressed. And that happened on several occasions in Egypt in the Ptolemaic period. We think we have really stressed out decades. And the 160s is another one. The 40s and the 30s, early 30s BC looks like it may be another one. So these are sort of cold decades, in fact. Now, there are adjustments. There are some, there's fiscal adjustments in how taxes are collected. We can see some, even some switches of the crops that are grown, for example, that farmers may not like to grow wheat. One of the things that's interesting about this period in Egypt is there's a major emphasis on free threshing wheat, bread wheat that the Greeks prefer. And that's quite drought sensitive, for example, compared to emmer wheat or barley. So if the switch of crops is adding more risk in the countryside, it doesn't do well in drier conditions, then you might understand why it is that farmers prefer to switch to maybe a hardier grain crop might do better. So we think we might even see some things like that. There's like a local strategy that's not surprising, but we think we can see that in tax records, for example. In terms of law, I kind of trying to remember what we talked about in terms of legal system, but of course it's related to how economy is working, how taxes are collected. We think, for example, that in stressed out decades, what we're trying to work on now are things like social indices of stress. So you might get more an increase of violence or more legal petitions that come in really stressed out periods of time. We've looked at that as well. We have work to do on that more, for example. So we think we can see patterns of responses. You know, not just a bad year, but to a bad decade, and how the state is trying to respond, because the state needs the grain to pay for many things, including military activity, to pay for the bureaucracy and et cetera. And farmers need to survive too. So we think we can see different societal responses from the top down. Let's say from this kind of work, the volcanoes are interesting because they're quite discrete shocks to the system. And because the dating resolution now is pretty good, we think we can have an historical window onto societal responses. And we're not trying to be determinist. We're not just saying, flood failure and then bad things happen. We see a lot of resilient responses. We also see, by the way, I think technological responses, some new irrigation machines and so on to help with poor flooding. There's some good or resilient responses to these stresses too. Stress sometimes is good for a society. You can see it. You can see societies adjusting almost year by year, in a resilient way. It's not collapse. It's not always a horrible thing, but it's these slight adjustments we think we can see now. All that means, just to conclude here about this topic, that it's not just climate change and then, oh, look, there's a response. So climate change causes X, Y, or Z. In other words, historical causality, this very challenging thing. No, I think what it does is now it gives us as historians, especially, an opportunity to go back to the historical record and kind of rethink how do these societies work and how do they change over time. So the climate data, I think, forces historians to be better historians.
That's a great way to look at it. Yeah. And maybe one small question that sprung to my mind now. I usually work in analyzing Neolithic graves and stuff. So we do a lot with bone analysis. Mm-hmm. And I was just now wondering, mm-hmm. if you say that not just a bad year, but maybe also a bad decade, do you also incorporate like analysis of stable isotopes from Egyptian graves to really also see that maybe the nutrition standard or growth of the teeth, of the bones? And so does this data also come into your models?
It should, and it certainly could, but I would say not yet. It's not always easy to get access to human remains that are in Egypt. There is an expert, a bioarchaeologist, coming to the conference in Bern in a couple of weeks.
Ah, okay.
Whom I will talk to about this. She works in the Sudan mainly, but she does work on this there. And because Egypt's one of these places where we do have a lot of human remains, I think it's quite possible to have a look at it. There are challenges, including dating of the human remains, I suppose. Certainly from the archaeology, but maybe there are more scientific ways of getting at more precise dating with C14 or other methods. But yeah, I think it's an untapped or virtually untapped resource yet or archive that some specialists do work on, but we haven't put the whole picture together yet. But it would be great, I think, to try to examine what things like that are telling us. Same with animals, presumably.
Yeah, yeah. Mm. And the second thing that I also sprung to my mind from your last comments, you said about the states, the responses of the state. I read in one of your articles that they even had to halt or draw back from a war that the Ptolemaic Egyptians had thought with the Seleucids, I think, in English.
Yes.
But I guess all of these, that also the Seleucids were affected by this Okmok eruption and the cooling that followed it. Or were they less, were some civilizations less affected because they were not so dependent on like the Nile floodings, for example?
Yeah, that's great. Now we're talking about more global climate responses to Okmok. It did have global impact. I'm pretty sure we would find, I think the Babylonian astronomical diaries stop in the 60s BC, where I'm being somewhat silly. These records we have from Babylon in the last 6 centuries BC that record the heights of the Euphrates River, but also commodity prices and weather observations and astronomical observations too, altogether. They're remarkable texts. But I think they end in the 60s BC. So I don't know if we have direct evidence of the Euphrates flooding in the 40s, but I think there are historical records that suggest some stress there. I would be shocked if there were not. We also know in China in the late 40s BC and 30s BC, there's widespread famine. So it looks like the East Asian monsoon was so impacted.
Yeah, thanks. And maybe as a final question, drawing parallels between ancient responses and contemporary climate challenges, what strategies or resilience measures from the past can maybe give us hints in addressing today's environmental crises?
I mean, I think the historical work on climate change, I'm writing a big book on this now, so this is front on my brain. At the moment, does historical experience matter for us going forward? Because we're in quite a different world in terms of historical experience of change. We're warming. I mean, historically, it's the cooling periods, either shorter or longer term, that seem to be more problematic for humans. That's the record of the Holocene, these downturns that are cooling downturns. But I think there's still a lot of important things that we can draw from, including just the wider, I mean, the more examples we have of human experience of climate change, I think, you know, the more diversity of human experience we have from around the world, how humans respond to different kinds of change is just an important database to have. It gives us more understanding and more things to think about human beings living in particular environments. So I think from general, some very important general things we can take away from historical climate work. We know the kinds of change that happen naturally. For example, the natural variability of the climate system, for example, and the forcings, the radiative forcings from solar activity and from volcanic forcing. We know what happens now. It's very well studied by Michael Siegel. In the last couple of years, especially, he's published the full Holocene record of volcanic eruptions. So this is extremely valuable information. And volcanic eruptions are the number one, the most important short-term driver of climate variability. That's really important to understand I think. And of course, they're not predictable. We have to be sort of aware, I think. We have to tread lightly on the earth, just in general, I think, to live gently on the earth, given that we live on it, we live in the environment still. We're not separated from them. So I think a lot of very more philosophical things that we can take away from human experience that I think matter a lot. I think more than is given credit in public policy thinking, actually.
Yeah, thank you very much. It really was really interesting to speak with you, to hear more about your research. And I hope we will see each other at the conference in Bern in June.
I'm looking forward very much to that, to being there in this beautiful city. And I look forward to seeing you there. And thanks for chatting.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much.
Pleasure. Pleasure.
All right, that's it for this episode. I hope you enjoyed this insight of how the combination of climate modeling, written sources, and archaeological data can tell us more about past human-environment interactions. Thanks again to Dr. Joe Manning, and if you enjoyed it as well, please follow and subscribe to this podcast. This also marks the last episode for season 2, and it was fascinating for me to cover such a diverse range of topics and speak with archaeologists from Ukraine, Syria, Colombia, or Ghana. I already have some interesting things in the making, so hopefully you'll tune in a couple of months for the third season of Archaeological Context with Dr. Noah.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.